The purpose of Retire with Style is to help you discover the retirement income plan that is right for you. The first step is to discover your retirement income personality. Start by going to risaprofile.com/style and sign up to take the industry's first financial personality tool for retirement planning. After Easter, it feels like a good time to relax a little bit and look at an easy question like solving world peace, great taste versus less filling, the ending of The Sopranos, or how to fund long-term care. So let's get into it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Retire with Style. I'm Alex, and I'm here with Wade. And today, we're going to be talking about options for funding long-term care expenses. Wade?
That's right, Alex. So thanks for joining the show. It sounds like you want to get directly into content. You don't have any exciting life events to share before we
Why would you say that? I was just confirming that this was the title of the podcast.
Well, that is indeed the case. Yes. Well, we'll introduce the four main funding options, but really do a deeper dive into self-funding today, which is to just pay out of pocket and not use one of the other three options.
And we'll do the initial dive into personal tidbits since we're coming off the Easter holiday right now. Wait, how did you enjoy the Easter bunny?
That's right. Yeah. The Easter bunny hid some eggs around the house, plastic eggs with candies. So that was pretty exciting. Maybe one of the last years we really do that in our household. We'll see what happens next year with. I think our youngest is starting to get suspicious about the Easter bunny at this point. So we'll see how.
Yeah. What do you put in the eggs? What's going on in the file household? What goodies do you put in the egg?
Well, the youngest one likes M&Ms, so they had some Easter themed pastel M&Ms. And some other chocolates. That's the main two things.
And how many peeps are in the Wade household during the festivity?
I saw them at the supermarket, but I did not get any peeps.
Why not?
It's not really my thing.
What about the kids?
I don't know if any of them have had a peep before. I don't know. They just don't look appetizing. So,
what are you talking about? They don't look appetizing. Speak for yourself, man.
How many did you have?
I don't know. You got to eat them fresh because if you wait a day, they kind of start getting, you know, hard. I can put down like one or two racks in one sitting pretty easily. Right. I wasn't just born like this, Wade. I had to work on this body. Many years of honing in on certain dietary habits that have perfected my peeps consumption. But there it is, man. Anything else happen or are we good? We good to start off? I'm just thinking out loud.
No, and yeah, we're recording. Usually, sometimes we have these in the can in advance, but this is literally within 12 hours after recording. This will be released, so it's pretty much in real time today, everyone.
And who can we thank for this?
I thank Bob French for this, but that's a whole other
thing. Yeah, Bob screwed us. He has a very special guest that he's going to have on.
He does.
He's going to sort of have a Bob French takeover in the next coming weeks, but we thought for whatever reason it was this week.
And all of a sudden, he was quite adamant. I thought he wanted to release it on April 2nd. And I thought that worked well as a good April Fool's joke that, Bob French took over the podcast. But turns out he changed his mind on the release date and didn't inform anyone of this. So
I don't remember it well. I don't even remember him giving us a date to begin with. But that's more me because you right away write things down on your paper calendar.
Paper calendar. That's right.
I just go by my invites and accept the invites and I wake up the day before, like around 5 o'clock, I look at my calendar for the next day and kind of see what I'm walking into. And whatever's there is there. I trust in it. And let the chips fall where they may after that.
All others bring data.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get cracking. Let's get cracking then with the four options. Now, this will be a little bit of a Q&A where I'm Q-ing and you're A-ing.
Sounds good.
But they're effectively four options. I'm at least giving my moment of glory here.
Mm-hmm. You name all four?
Yeah. C C R O C C R. No. There's self-funding with personal assets. We got that one. Medicaid, not Medicare, and wait, we'll get into that one. Traditional long-term care insurance and hybrid policies, combining long-term care with life insurance or annuity.
Very good.
And so I think, thank you. Thank you. I'm done now. Silence is golden. No, but as you can tell, we can't unpack all of these. So we're going to try to unpack the self-funding today. And we'll bring in some guests for the others, and we'll do our own thing as well. Now, there is a little quirk here, right, for eligible veterans?
Well, yeah, that's just maybe you could put an asterisk that there could be a fifth option that the Veterans Administration may have some options for veterans as well. So if you have veteran status, thank you for your service. And you may also look at whether there are any benefits available through the Veterans Administration. But we won't be going into depth on that one.
All right. So first, let's go into what not is on the list, since it was with exclamation points and everything. Why is Medicare not on the list?
Right. And it's very easy to confuse Medicare with Medicaid. They sound pretty similar. It's just two letters different. But Medicaid is a funding option, and we'll talk more about that in a future episode. That's for people who have effectively depleted other resources. Medicare, your retirement health insurance that most people become eligible for at age 65, is not long-term care. They are distinct. Medicare is for health-related issues. There is a common misperception that Medicare will pay for long-term care support. And there is a way to potentially get limited benefits through Medicare, but it really doesn't fulfill the definition of long-term care. And it's fairly restrictive. It's to receive something that might look like long-term care through Medicare, you have to spend at least 3 nights in a hospital. And it has to be, this can be an issue. Just because you're 3 nights in a hospital doesn't mean it's classified properly as the 3 nights of inpatient care. But at least 3 nights. Then you're confined to a home or institution requiring skilled nursing or rehabilitative care for the same condition from a Medicare certified professional as prescribed by a doctor, and you are expecting a full recovery. So if you meet this, perhaps if you break a hip could be an example, then you receive the three inpatient days. You do need rehabilitative care, either at a facility or at home. You're getting that from a Medicare certified professional. It was prescribed by a doctor. You are expecting a full recovery. If you meet that scenario, you can get full benefits for the first 20 days with Medicare, and then you get partial support for 80 days after that for a total of 100 days. Now, that partial support can still mean it's quite expensive for the part not covered through Medicare. But if you have a comprehensive Medicare supplement, that would cover you fully for 100 days. But then it stops. And usually we think of long-term care as not lasting. I mean, really, the starting point of long-term care is 100 days. Medicare is stopping at 100 days. So it's not Medicare in that regard.
It's long-term care, we're going to call it, because 100 days. But it's really almost like rehab care.
Yeah, rehab from something that you're expecting a full recovery.
This happened to my grandfather-in-law. He broke his hip. He had an operation, and during that operation, he actually had a stroke. And he was in a care, 3 days at the hospital, and then he was at a rehab facility expecting a recovery. Because of the stroke, though, it really threw a wrench into the expected recovery day. He just fulfilled his 100 days, but he had to move afterwards. So to your point, it wasn't like a long-term care. It was like, okay, Medicare is up. Now we need to find another solution.
Oh, yeah. With lasting, in this case, he needed more than 100 days of care, but
yeah,
Medicare stops entirely. Yeah. That's a good example where we really shouldn't be thinking of Medicare as a long-term care funding source. It's potentially very limited circumstances.
That's what it's not.
So that's not for custodial care.
Matt. Yeah.
Right. Usually long-term care is more custodial care related, which is not medical care, but help with the activities of daily living. If you just need help with activities of daily living, that wouldn't qualify for these Medicare benefits.
Okay. And so what are the breakdowns of more or less the long-term care cost? If people are thinking about an equation in their head.
Yeah. So if we're starting to think about what's going to be your out-of-pocket costs for long-term care, it's, and this is related to self-funding versus insurance, your any expenses. So if you never have a long-term care event, your expenses are zero. But any out-of-pocket expenses to pay for long-term care, plus if you do have long-term care insurance, any premiums for that insurance, minus any benefits received through the insurance. So if you're purely self-funding, you don't have long-term care insurance. So you're not paying any premiums, you're not getting any benefits. The cost of long-term care is simply what it costs to pay for that long-term care out of pocket. And that's in the context of asset liability matching for retirees. That's kind of the whole conversation around insurance. A significant long-term care event is a liability that may or may not happen. If you have insurance, it will partially offset the impact, financial impact of that liability by providing a benefit. You've leveraged your premium dollars to provide a larger benefit to offset some of that out-of-pocket cost. So you're creating that consumption smoothing. That's what insurance is all about.
Okay. So you're thinking about funding it. You're probably not going to be thinking about the consumption smoothing component, at least an individual. Yeah, but wait, unless they're using some, what is it? Maxify or something like that?
Software.
What are the components that go into choosing a funding strategy?
Yeah, so some of the things you'll want to think about, age, and that can relate to if at higher ages, insurance is underwritten. So at some point, you may not qualify for long-term care insurance. So to the extent age fits into that, health can fit into that. Family health history can relate to that. If you have a history of dementia or other conditions that may require more long-term care support, it's obviously a consideration. Your ability to receive help from family or friends in an informal manner for that informal or unpaid care in a manner that's not too much of a burden for them. Wealth levels and how that interacts with Medicaid. Because if you're in more of a scenario where if you have a significant long-term care event, you're simply not going to be able to self-pay. But then you may qualify for Medicaid. And so, well, is qualifying for Medicaid a realistic consideration for your financial plan? What are your legacy objectives in terms of what you'd like to leave behind? What's your risk tolerance as it relates to the uncertainty around long-term care spending shocks and how that would impact your living standard net of those long-term care expenses? And also just the costs and benefits of different types of insurance policies. Kind of all the factors you want to be thinking about when it comes to choosing a funding approach for long-term care.
Yeah, and there's nothing here that's out of the ordinary. This is just the standard, you know, tried and true, like financial planning considerations for any funding strategies, you know, really. What you want to unpack maybe the risk tolerance for long-term spending shocks? Does that have to do with like the new risk you face in retirement? One of them are spending shocks. And so how much of that is that a risk that you want to take off the table? Is that how you mean it? Just because if people are listening in, they may hear risk tolerance and think, there's a risk tolerance question here for you. And that's not how you're meaning it.
Right. Yeah. This may not, I'm sure it's come up in the podcast at some point, but it's maybe not something we've spent a lot of time talking about. There's this whole idea of what does risk tolerance mean in financial planning? Well, in the context of a risk tolerance questionnaire, it's short-term market volatility. But that doesn't really have much impact on people necessarily over the long term. Risk tolerance in the context of financial planning is more the risk to your lifestyle. What happens if events happen, whether it's a market downturn, whether it's living much longer than expected, whether it's experiencing a significant financial shock like a long-term care need, what happens to the household's lifestyle in retirement? And if you're more risk tolerant, it just implies you're more flexible about your lifestyle. You'll go with the flow, and if everything works out fine, you have a pretty enjoyable retirement. If you get hit by a shock like this, you're going to have to reduce the standard of living for the household. And if you're more risk tolerant, you're okay with that idea that, okay, we'll just spend less. That's fine. If you're risk averse, you don't want to deal with those types of financial shocks. You really want to maintain the same lifestyle with the same sort of predictable income in the context of the retirement income style awareness. If you're more of a income protection or safety first, that tends to correlate more with wanting predictable income in retirement, whereas total returns or primarily total returns is much less worried about having predictable income. There's more of a sense of being flexible, i.e. risk tolerant, when it comes to the potential impacts of things like a long-term care spending shock.
Let's take a moment to let the audience know that this show is sponsored by Retirement Researcher. You can learn more about Retirement Researcher at retirementresearcher.com and subscribe to our newsletter, where you'll receive weekly actionable information for your retirement planning benefit. Retirement Researcher is an online community devoted to helping you create the retirement income plan geared towards your goals.
Well, you bring up a good point. I mean, we've been focusing a little bit on longevity aversion on certain things, and people on the lower end of the RISA matrix, risk wrap, income protection, you know, their longevity aversion is a very salient concern for them, where you have a lot of, strong valence for the emotional center of spending shocks. And spending shocks go both ways, right? There's medical spending, there's chronic illness kind of thing, spending shocks, this kind of stuff related, and then my roof fell off and I need to fix that kind of spending shock. And those are people that really crave that true liquidity, which is having things more earmarked for potential shocks so then they can be more comfortable with other things. We see that people to the left of the RISA matrix. A lot of those folks have this sense of true liquidity preference, which, you know, that's used to fight against spending shocks. And that's in the bucketing time segmentation strategy and also in the income protection. It's in everything, but, you know, on a relative basis, you see it more with those folks.
Yeah, that's a good point about the true liquidity. Okay. You want to have something earmarked for a long-term care spending shock. The technical liquidity, which is more on the right with the total returns investing or risk wrap, that's more the sense of, I just want to have a pot of assets that I'll draw from as necessary. So I'm not really worried about earmarking something specifically for long-term care. If I have to self-pay for long-term care, I'll take it out of my pot of assets and pay for it. And if that means I have to cut lifestyle in other places, though, I mean, long-term care is a little bit harder to speak about in that context, but maybe other family members have to cut lifestyle in that context. There's flexibility to do that.
Perfect. And so, wait, what are some considerations that people can start, you know, when they're thinking about this? And it could be as simple as just, you know, introducing other family members into this. Like, what do you suggest?
Well, absolutely. When you make a long-term care plan, you don't want to keep that to yourself. You want to share the information. Make sure other family members are on board, especially if part of it is they're going to be providing informal care to you. Make sure that they're on board with that and to avoid misunderstandings in that regard. Yes. And then also just if you have a specific asset earmarked for supporting long-term care, whether it's kind of an idea of potentially using a reverse mortgage to tap equity of the home to pay for in-home care, whether it's actually a long-term care insurance policy, whether it's even life insurance. If you have permanent life insurance, you may not even realize that a lot of those policies may have an acceleration of death benefit rider that allows you to get the death benefit to help pay for long-term care while you're alive in that context. So anytime you have an asset in mind that could help fund long-term care, making sure your family members know about that so that they, if they don't know about it, like if they didn't know your life insurance policy had an acceleration of death benefit rider that you're planning to use to pay for your long-term care and you become incapacitated, well, they're not going to know they should have done that. So make sure the family understands your plan for funding long-term care and is on board with any sort of requirements you have in mind for them in terms of being caregivers or whatever roles they may have in the plan.
Okay. And frankly, they may have some ideas. Wade, as we now transition into the self-funding piece of it and unpack that, before we get into the, you know, the bullet point party, a comment, a concept that I think is worth mentioning here, because some of this is you're looking at the entire balance sheet, is this idea that money is fungible. Because I think some folks really think, all right, I need cash. I don't have $500,000 in cash, $300,000 in cash. I'm not ready for this. And I want them to relax that assumption from cash to, you know, include just your asset base. Because at the end of the day, money is fungible. Can you speak a little bit about that as an unwrapping to self-funding strategies?
Yeah, and that's, we'll need to talk about, like, just how do you allocate the assets earmarked for long-term care? If you are earmarking something for that, it's, you don't necessarily, like, if you're at an extreme, so I want to have $500,000 set aside for long-term care, you can't really just necessarily leave that in cash when it may not actually be needed for 20 years. But at the same time, if you invest it, it's kind of what we talk about. The sooner you need the funds, the less aggressive you can invest them. You have to rely more on having that value fixed. Long-term care presents a problem for that because you don't know when you're going to need those funds or if you're going to need those funds. And so you have to choose an asset allocation around that. And that ultimately may mean not just having all those funds set aside in cash, whether you have more of that technical liquidity mindset so that you're investing in the overall portfolio, or whether you are earmarking something for long-term care. Well, in many cases, it may be your house. That's kind of your, I'll use the house as necessary to pay for long-term care, sell the house, move into an institution, use a reverse mortgage to tap into the home equity to pay for in-home care, or whatever you have in mind for that. Ultimately, you may not want that to just be a huge pile of cash sitting on the sidelines throughout your retirement as your reserves for long-term care expenses.
But this goes back to even talking to folks, because you're using the house as an example, but I think the house is where there's just a strong emotional consideration. And my mom, you know, even to this day, is like, oh, I wish I had my house. But the reality is, if you're talking to your, let's say your children about long-term care and your children are fine, and your parents have this idea that they're going to leave you the house, but the house comes at the expense of doing some sort of fire drill for your long-term care, it's not worth it. And this goes back to the concept of, you know, you have a balance sheet and you have assets and everything is fungible, right? The fact that it's, you know, a certain amount of money has kind of morphed itself into a house. Another pot has morphed itself into some sort of investment portfolio. It's still money that you can be able to access. And if you do speak with your children about this, they may very well say, yeah, you know what? Don't worry about us with the house. Why don't we access that capital, you know, potentially downsize, make it ready so I can grow old in it and use the proceeds and develop a reverse mortgage from it and then use that as a buffer asset if needed to fund something down the line. You know, I'm trying to get at with, I'm just trying to just open up someone's purview of assets are fungible. Mm-hmm. And you should look at that when you're thinking about self-funding.
Yeah. And even in the true liquidity context where you do want to earmark different assets for different purposes, there's still a degree of fungibility in terms of you don't have to be very precise about how assets are earmarked.
Okay. All right. And so what do the funding sources include in someone's asset sheet, if you will? We obviously said house were the ones that people could be like, oh yeah, I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when we're talking about self-funding for long-term care, house, just part of the investment portfolio that's kind of in excess, you have excess reserves beyond what you need to meet other goals. Sometimes also a life insurance policy. It may not be specifically one where you can tap into the death benefit in advance to pay for long-term care, but just the cash value in a life insurance policy may be another consideration there. But it's what you have in mind for how you're going to pay for long-term care that doesn't cross that line into being leveraged insurance dollars. It's really a one-to-one, okay, anything I take from that asset to pay for long-term care reduces my net worth by the amount of that distribution.
Okay. And what impact would these expenditures have on the, like, your standard of living, if you will, or potential beneficiaries? That's, you know, those are fertile ground for discussions as well. as you're thinking about trade-offs?
Yeah, that's where the volatility kind of comes in. And this is where, for you as the individual needing long-term care, this kind of conversation around spending flexibility and standard of living kind of drops to the side, because it's, if you need long-term care, you're not really going to be using your budget to take international trips or to go to nice restaurants. You kind of really can reallocate your retirement budget into the long-term care, but it's just potentially for large, significant events. How much volatility is that going to create for remaining assets, either for a surviving spouse or for the spouse who's not yet surviving, but the spouse in this scenario, and potential beneficiaries such as children? If you had in mind that you would leave them a particular inheritance, that you end up, because of self-funding, need to tap significantly into that to pay for long-term care, obviously there's then a smaller inheritance. And so how much flexibility do you have with these numbers fluctuating in response to these random spending shocks that you experience?
Okay. And we were talking about this before, and this was going into bringing in insurance and maybe, you know, helping sharing that risk with somebody else, you know, from an insurance standpoint. You want to expand upon that?
Yeah, it's, the whole idea of insurance is kind of in different states of the world, you want to smooth what happens. So in the state of the world where you don't experience any long-term care event, if you pay for insurance, you'll have a lower standard of living. It's just whatever you are going to spend minus the insurance premiums. And then the insurance doesn't pay off. And then in other scenarios where you do have a significant long-term care event, you're going to have a higher standard of living, or again, it's not necessarily you that has the higher standard of living, but other people in your household or beneficiaries would have a higher standard of living because those premium dollars get leveraged and will pay out a lot more in benefits due to the insurance and risk pooling that is provided by insurance, so that the standard of living gets more equalized in states of the world where you don't have a long-term care need, states of the world where you do have a long-term care need. And so consumption smoothing is all about that idea of, let's smooth my standard of living no matter what happens with relation to a long-term care event.
Perfect. And so in terms of coming up with the numbers, at the start of this arc, we threw some numbers out there, both cost of, like, there's cost for like your family helping you out, right? You may not pay for those directly, but society pays the costs, or your brother or your son or your daughter, you know, there's a cost, right? Everyone has an hourly rate if you really break it down, and there's a cost to that. And but we also spoke about costs, about out-of-pocket costs that you could spend. Is it fair to say that we'll help folks estimate reserves for self-funding later on in this arc?
Yeah, we'll talk more about that process as well.
So don't get into too much then right now. So
one more note on this idea of self-funding too is, just usually we think about insurance as useful to pay for low probability, high cost events, because then if it's a low probability event, that helps to reduce premiums. The fundamental problem with long-term care, and so why self-funding may be the best option in some cases, long-term care is not necessarily a low probability event. There's a reasonable probability that people with insurance are going to be able to claim those benefits. And so you're not able to leverage those insurance dollars as much. And so that impacts some of the calculus around, well, should I use insurance or should I self-pay?
And like in all things in life, if you had to like do a best guess, who would be the best ideal persona for someone that could probably self-fund? And it's an obvious answer, but you know, say it out loud so everyone kind of hears it.
Mm-hmm. Well, people who have assets, or maybe who at least have enough assets to get the ball rolling before Medicaid becomes a reality in self-funding cases. People who are more risk averse can benefit. I'm sorry, less risk averse, and more flexible with their ability to go with the flow, to reduce expenditures in other categories if they have a long-term care need, has more flexibility in relation to their spending. So, and also with that being more risk tolerant, how would you allocate the funds to pay for long-term care? If you invest them more aggressively, or if you're willing to assume a higher rate of return on those assets, you won't have to earmark as much for long-term care needs.
Yeah.
Versus if you're going to have this sitting in cash, well, at some point you might be better off with insurance, because insurance might provide a cash-like return plus the ability to leverage those dollars if you have a need.
Are you getting close to, or are you in retirement? Well, investing during retirement is a little bit different than during your working years. Your investments are there to help you pay for retirement, and now is when they need to earn their keep. To make sure you're on the right track, download Retirement Researcher's 8 Tips to Becoming a Retirement Income Investor by heading over to retirementresearcher.com/8tips. Again, get Retirement Researcher's 8 Tips to Becoming a Retirement Income Investor by going to retirementresearcher.com/8tips. That's the number 8, tips.
Has anyone done like almost like a target date fund, but not for retirement, for long-term care probabilities? It'd be kind of interesting. Like, you know, they assume if, you know, by 85, you're going to need something for sure, you know, at that point.
Oh.
And so they kind of do a target date fund around that age. Again, I'm just literally making this up, but
that maybe, I mean, there's a, I think you might have, there's a conversation around annuities in this regard, not like annuities linked to long-term care benefits, but simply the QLAC, the qualified longevity annuity contract. Yeah, if I have an annuity that earns on at age 85, it's not at all a perfect correlation, but to the extent that that's when I'll need long-term care, having this new potentially relatively large income source turning on at the time correlated with when I'm most likely to need long-term care, that you could, I think you could fit into that framework of here's a way to plan for having more income when there's a better chance I'll need it. For
actually, I was planning on doing that with a QLAC, you know, with my, you know, part of my qualified money and my wife, well, when that fact comes, are you thinking about using the QLAC?
Yeah, I think about it from time to time and was looking at pricing.
Now that you stay late.
Yeah, if you're in your 40s looking to turn it on at 85, the payout rates can be more than 100%. So it's like, now there's inflation that's going to impact the next 40 years, but you can get a pretty decent payout on a life-only QLAC, at least.
All right.
Most people want cash about,
I don't look at the quotes that you look at the quotes daily?
No, I don't look at them daily, but I did look at them once because I was thinking about the so I would have to move my retirement assets somewhere else because my current provider doesn't offer QLACs. So it would be a hassle, but I was at least thinking about it at one point.
Current as in McLean? Like our
Not McLean. Vanguard. Vanguard used to have low cost annuity options and they took them away. So I'm not happy about that.
Yeah. I got you. Fidelity does a good job with that, don't they? Not that we're
Yeah. They're much better about offering annuities.
Just thinking out loud here. Lucy, who's the one that, Blanchett. Blanchett looks at quotes all the time. He loves the kind of like box score, if I may.
Yeah, right. He does.
All right. So you introduce risk tolerance. What are some ways to aligning your self-funding with the risk tolerance portion of it in the traditional sense?
You mean in terms of
being more conservative at the beginning? I mean, being more aggressive at the beginning, quote unquote, of that earmark, and then slowly being more conservative. Is there anything more than that?
Not really. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's a hard problem because like we're saying, we don't know when you'll need to start paying for long-term care. So you don't know how much time horizon you have. So you don't know when you should start getting more conservative with those investments. That's where the money being fungible. With
it. As we're talking about it, there really is no, I am going to hit the QLAC fire, but even then you just have to make peace with it to some extent. And say, yeah, I'm gonna responsibly, you know, put some set aside so I don't stick it to my kids, really. at the end of it, all right. You have here, you have a point that you made that we didn't get into, but what about spending guilt? How does that play into self funding? That's the self funding dynamic, and I imagine the spending guilt happens when you're not sick at that point.
Yeah. So that's kind of an ongoing thing. That's one of the potential benefits of having long-term care insurance is if you need care, you have no qualms about tapping into those benefits. But a reality that can face people is if they're going to self-fund and they need care, they feel guilty about spending that money on care. And it could be their family could be great. Please, this is your money. Use it for your care. They still feel guilty about it. There could even be cases where there is like more pressure of, hey, I don't want you to receive long-term care because that's tapping into my inheritance. I want that money for myself. And that can also be more of an issue with blended families, potentially, with the spouse and the stepchildren and all that. But if you need care and you're self-funding, are you going to actually be comfortable spending that money for care? That's the guilt element. Whether or not there's any explicit pressure, which of course makes it worse, but even without explicit pressure, you may still feel guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I you say guilt, right? And this is me being ticky-tacky. So let's say someone, they underspend, right? And this is where if you have an annuity or some sort of pension at work, you have this license to spend. When it comes to just pulling assets, and this is not a long-term care license to spend, just a regular license to spend, when you have this sort of pension of some sort in place, I'm wondering if you choose self-funding, how much of this is sort of a learned behavior? Because if you're self-funding and your biggest fear becomes, I don't want to outlive my assets and I don't want to, you know, ruin myself with some distressful chronic illness that I developed that I need long-term care, or just the normal thing of aging, all of a sudden I need chronic care. I wonder if you're self-funding, then you get into this mind space. What are you doing is saving at all costs, and you're used to saving and accumulating. Not accumulating from the standpoint of, I want to be Jeff Bezos and, you know, I only got 3 years left, but I need to go all out. Accumulating more, just normal accumulation, because that's what you're supposed to do to make sure that you cover not running out, you know, your longevity fears, and you cover potential liquidity crisis, right? I think, Wade, it's very hard to change that behavior all of a sudden. And you have a chronic, and you start tapping into it. Because when you tap into it, obviously the gas tank starts going in the other direction. And so you're talking about guilt as in, like, I don't want my kids to feel bad because it's a dwindling net worth that I have. And all of a sudden, I can't leave what I had been.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, I that's a valid point. But I also think some of it has to do with, you have such an ingrained behavior
mm-hmm.
that all of a sudden change that mindset after behaving in a certain way for 30 years of stimulus response. I think it's just stuck. I think it's just stuck to turn that off.
Yeah, you don't like spending. Maybe the reason you didn't buy long-term care insurance is you don't like spending money. So you also don't like spending money on anything. So you don't want
to. Look, I'm being ticky-tacky with the word guilt. Who knows, right? But I think there's more at play than just like, I feel guilt that
spending mindset.
I'm not going to have a beach house.
But the guilt could be a factor too. It's where it's simply
absolutely.
I was thinking this would be my kid's inheritance, and now I'm going to spend it on long-term care. I'm not going to spend it. That's kind of the scenario that insurance at least would help avoid in that context.
I don't disagree. I was just kind of like, I don't know, thinking out loud more than anything.
Nitpicking.
Huh?
Nitpicking.
You know me. All right, so self-funding and informal caregivers.
Right, and just one other aspect. Well, this whole issue of not wanting to spend money on long-term care needs. Well, are you going to have your family or friends be informal caregivers? Ultimately, it's been estimated up to 70% of long-term care may be provided through informal family support. We talked in an earlier episode about like the duration of long-term care events, and making that distinction between any care versus paid care. The duration of paid care is a lot shorter than the duration of any care. But that means if I have a 3-year long-term care event, it may be the first 2.5 years where unpaid informal care from family members, the last half a year was for paid care when it just became too much of a burden. But we have to be clear that there's a cost to unpaid care that you really have to internalize if you're thinking about self-funding for long-term care.
Well, this is where, wait, I don't know if it tells you, but after I retire, I'm going to move to Dallas and I'm going to call you. Hey, Wade, what are you doing?
And I'll be your unpaid caregiver. I'll be your unpaid caregiver.
when you go to CVS, can you pick up some things for me?
Yeah.
That, you're right. I mean,
it's a joke, but the reality is with the unpaid care, just people may have to sacrifice careers to become unpaid caregivers. So then they're not earning salary. They're not contributing into Social Security. They're not getting ready for their own retirements. Plus the stress and burden of being a caregiver might ruin their health and make them more likely to also need long-term care at some point. So it's not free when you get unpaid care.
You've seen it for the last few years here. I'm very fortunate because, you know, McLean is our business and we're not necessarily, I'm not clocking in, clocking out. So there's a lot of flexibility. But what did you say? I go to Miami probably every, 70, 80 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like 3 or 4 days to, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. And that's a good example stuff. Where if you had a job where it's not so easy to get time off to do that, it could be real problematic.
Yeah. And I can't snap my fingers and have my parents move here. That's just not realistic on a whole host of levels. So yeah, there's a cost to this that's significant, but I'm in a very fortunate situation, but I can see somebody that the normal case is somebody that's working for a company. I mean, I don't know how they would do it, frankly, you know, without there being some significant costs,
mm-hmm.
like out of money costs as well. But no, I you're 100% right on that.
Right. Missed salary, missed work-related benefits. And then, yeah, out-of-pocket costs. If you're traveling back and forth, maybe it's a 100-mile difference. So you're making that drive a couple times a week. The wear and tear on the automobile, anything related to that. The costs can be significant even with unpaid care.
No, the cost of it, but, you know, you say this, but also the person receiving the care, at the end of the day, it's not coming out of their pocket, so they could say, well, so what? But I think over time, whether it's the kid feels like the son or the daughter feels like some sort of obligation to help, and I'm sure they're happy to, and there's, you know, most of the time it's no worries, but you can't help but think that after a while, anything in life starts getting, I don't know, old is too strong a word, but you know what I mean? There's going to be some resentment in some way, shape, or form, constantly, you know, going to the well like that. I just think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I've learned not to try to be too predictive about future episodes, but I do think with our next episode, we'll have an opportunity to talk with someone who's created an adult daycare center, which actually can be a very important solution for this type of informal caregiver to, from 9 to 5, getting help, support, so that they can maintain their job, which if they had to be a 24-hour-a-day caregiver would not be possible, frankly, in most scenarios.
Okay. And then the last point to take us home before we transition for the next episode is self-funding with annuities. And we're going to talk about this to a greater extent with hybrid stuff. But as a general matter, just self-funding with annuities. Take it away, man.
Yeah, yeah. We ended up talking about that already, if you recall, because you brought it up earlier. The QLACs and stuff. That's where...
QLACs. Oh, yeah. I just don't even consider QLACs. It's its own, like, world. You know what I'm saying?
This is a test of if you're listening to the podcast as we do it.
I just said I was going to get QLAC. No, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. That's the idea with the self-funding QLAC.
Almost like an extension of a 401k plan or something like that.
It's just you have an annuity that will turn on at approximately the age where you're more likely to need long-term care. So it's not at all a perfect match, but it is a way to potentially get some additional funds at a period in life when you may need more funds.
Yeah, and for those listening, you know, scoring at home, what's the limit on the QLAC right now? 200 and change, right?
Yeah, so it was $200,000. I can't remember if this was the year that now became $205,000 because it is now inflation linked, unlike in the past.
Okay, fine. Low 200. It's not going to be
right around 200.
Yeah, you know.
But like I was saying, if you're in your 40s, the payout rate can be more than 100%. So that could be more than $200,000 a year of income starting at age 85. Although probably not many QLACs are purchased by people in their 40s.
And that's why they have that payout, right? All right. Anything else, Wade, for today?
No, I think that'll do it. So yeah, a lot more exciting episodes to come on Retire With Style.
All right, everyone.
thank you for listening, and we look forward to Bob getting around and doing his episode, giving us a little bit of a respite, but we look forward to catching you guys next week. Take it easy, everyone.
Yeah, Bob's coming, I think, later in April, but next week will still be long-term care.
Excellent.
Thanks, everyone.
All right, wait.
Bye.
Bye.
Wade and Alex are both principals in McLean Asset Management and retirement researcher. Both are SEC-registered investment advisors located in Tysons, Virginia. The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational and educational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific securities. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor. All investing comes with a risk, including risk of loss. Past performance does not guarantee future results.